Now, listen, last time on the 14th chapter, there's a point that I didn't have time quite to finish. And I want to just go back and spend a moment on that. And that is the 12th chapter, of 12th verse, I mean, of the 14th chapter. How art thou fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground that is laid low the nations? Now, I made the statement that that passage is often quoted and used with reference to Satan. Satan is not under consideration in this passage. Lucifer here has reference, or son of the morning, has reference to the king of Babylon. Well, that's what he is talking about in this, and goes on down, and in the middle of verse 16 it says, is this the man that made the earth to tremble, that did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness, and overthrew the cities thereof, and let not loose his prisoners to their home? Now in verse 19, but thou art cast forth from thy sepulchre. Verse 20, thou shalt not be joined, and so on. And down in verse 22, and I will rise up against them, saith Jehovah of hosts, and cut off from Babylon name and remnant and son and son's son and so on. Now, he's talking here about the king of Babylon and what he's going to do to Babylon itself. So, I think it's a total mistake for anyone to think of Lucifer here as having reference to Satan. Now, you've seen that in so many of the writings of different men, but if you read the context, always study every passage or every subject in the light of its context. So this is a prophecy against Babylon, against the king of Babylon, who had sought to destroy nations and make them his. Right? We dealt with that king in the second chapter of Habakkuk about two or three Sunday nights ago, when we used the little book of Habakkuk for our lesson. Now in verse 28, now comes the prophecy against Philistia. Now, there's something like 10 different nations that are prophesied against in these chapters, 13 to 23. Now, in the year that King Ahaz died was this bird. Now, that was in 715 B.C. Ahaz died 715, so this is probably, I think, about the only dated prophecy in the group here. There might be another one, but this at least is one of them is dated. And I said, rejoice not, O Philistia, all of thee, because the rod that smote thee is broken. For out of the serpent's root shall come forth an adder, and his fruit shall be a fiery serpent. And the firstborn of the poor shall feed, and the needy shall lie down in safety. And I will kill thy root with famine, and thy remnant shall be slain. Howl, O gate, cry, O city, thou art melted away. O Philistia, all of thee, for there cometh a smoke out of the north, and there is no straggler in his ranks. Now, Philistia, as you recall, was located here. As you come up here, come on down here, and here come down Jerusalem over here. Now, here was Philistia, this land along the sea coast. Now, the Philistines were in that country when Abraham went in. Also, they were there when Moses came in. And they've been there all through this time and were bitter enemies of the Jews from the time the Jews came in. And you remember that King Saul was killed in a battle with the Philistines, he and his son Jonathan. And the Philistines were a constant threat to them. David finally conquered them, but not completely. Didn't completely, because when David died, Solomon broke out again. So here, now there's a question in here as to what he means by the serpent's root and an adder and a fiery serpent. I've read a number of explanations of that. Some of them I reject completely. I think the best explanation, since Philistia continued on down until even the days of Zechariah, one of the last of the minor prophets. So if they continued on, then you've got to get an answer in the light of that. I think that what he's talking about is Assyria, who was the dominant power at that time, then Babylon, and then the fiery serpent is an unknown power that would finally destroy them. It was not even identified, because if they continue on down to the end of the Old Testament, near the end, why certainly then he would speak of them in some figurative sense, like the fiery serpent. So I think that that's what he's talking about, and that's the best explanation I can give on that. But God will ultimately bring Philistia to an end. He'll take them root and branch. They'll be completely destroyed. Now he's asked this question. What then shall one answer the messengers of the nation? that Jehovah hath founded Zion, and in her shall the afflicted of his people take refuge. Now the, by the way, did I talk about the Assyrian last time? I don't believe I did, but pass over that anyway. But now, in Zion is where refuge is always going to be found. Now it was Zion of the Old Testament. When that was destroyed, then it looked under the Zion that was to come, the spiritual Zion. I think even back there, when it talks about Zion, it's a spiritual relation with God that's going to save an individual. Not the fact that he was in Jerusalem, because Jerusalem was destroyed. But at any rate, here will be the place of refuge, will be in Zion. All right. Then I did overlook Assyria up here. And why does Assyria come in there? I think Assyria will have to be destroyed before Babylon becomes a great power, and she will be destroyed. Seems to me to be the thought there. At any rate, let's pass from that. So we have two now. We have three, out of Babylon and Assyria and the Philistia. Now he turns to Moab. Now Moab is this country. Over here is your Dead Sea coming down here. And this is more. Here was the Arnon River. Here was the Zered River. Now, Moab did extend up just a little bit north of this river, about 8 or 10 miles. The borders it. And from the Dead Sea on out here to the Arabian Desert. No particular limit out there. And Moab, the Moabites, as you of course already know, were descendants of Lot by one of his daughters. Up here were the Ammonites. Here's Moab, and up here is Ammon, up here. Now, Ammonites and the Moabites were descendants of Lot. Therefore, they were kindred Israelite. Go back to Terah. Terah, you remember, had three sons. And Lot was the son of one of them, hence he was a nephew of Abraham. So that makes them related. And from the time that the Jews came into the land, there was enmity between the Moabites and the Ammonites on the one hand and the Jews on the other. Now here's a prophecy against the Moabites. I'm going to read a good deal of that. Now there's something like 23 cities named in chapters 15 and 16. Only about 10 of them can be identified as the location. Now I'm not interested in that. Not important that you can locate them or not, for the point of this is the misery that's coming upon Moab because of a pride, because of a rejection of God's people and any relation to God, the enmity against God. Right? Now the burden of Moab. For in a night, R of Moab is laid waste. Now that night, I don't think it means coming at night, it just means in an instant of time, in a short time rather, and brought to naught. For in a night cur, now these are cities of Moab who laid waste. They're gone up to bed. And he goes on to name some of these. Now look at verse 3. In their streets they gird themselves with sackcloth. On their housetops, in their broad places, everyone waileth, weeping abundantly. And Heshbon crieth out, and Eleale, their voices heard even unto Jahaz. Therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. That is in despair. Now notice what's going to happen to Moab as he names these different ones here. That they're going to adorn themselves with sackcloth. They're going to wail. They're going to weep. They're going to cry out. The cry of despair, not of victory and of triumph, but of despair. But this is what's coming upon them. Now he goes on to say here, I cry aloud. His soul trembleth within him. Now hear the response of the prophet Isaiah. My heart crieth out for Moab. Her nobles flee into Zoar. Eglath Shalishiah, for by the ascent of this other place, so I'm not concerned with that, but the point is here that my heart crieth out for Moab. The prophet realizing the terrible judgment that's coming upon these, even his enemies, his heart goes out for them. Down in verse 11 of chapter 16 has another statement, wherefore my heart soundeth like a harp for Moab, and mine inward parts for Kerheres, one of the cities. So the judgment is going to be so terrible that the prophet, as he utters the prophecy, his heart cries out. He is touched with that which is coming upon them. Now, he mentions several cases here, like verse 6, the waters of Nimrim shall be desolate, for the grass withered. Now, that's 8 miles north. Nimrim is about 8 miles north of the end of the Dead Sea. That's why I say it extends on up here somewhere. And borders, those borders were not always clearly defined. Then he comes on down here, the waters of Nimrim. Now drop down here to about the middle last of verse 7 here. They shall carry away over the book of the willows. Now, the book of the willows is probably Zered. That's this one right here. This is the river or brook Zered that heads up here and flows down into the Dead Sea. That's probably the brook of willows. For the cry is gone round about the borders of Moab, the wailing thereof unto Eglaim, and the wailing thereof unto Beer Elam, for the waters of Dimon, and that's possibly the Arnon. I'm not sure. Wait a minute. I'm wrong. This is not Zered. This is the Arnon. Here's the Arnon. And this is the book Zered down here. I knew better than that. Well, that's Zered down there. Right, so what he's talking about here, the waters of Dimon, which is probably the Arnon, are full of blood. Here there was the Zered down here that they cross over here, the waters of Zered, and then there's the Arnon. Now notice, it's the waters are bloody from the slaughter of the men in battle as they come upon them. It's a very, very dark picture for Moab, terribly dark. And he goes on to say that a line upon them of Moab that escape, and upon the remnant of the land. So here's a terrible picture of the judgment that's coming against Moab. They'll try to flee, they won't be able to. The river or water will run with blood. They'll try to cross and get away. Alright? Now, in the 16th chapter, first verse, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. We're not interested in it, except to show the judgment against these heathen nations, and God brings it. Now, this first here, send the either lambs for the ruler of the land from Selah, that's Petra, to the wilderness under the mount of the daughter of Zion. Now, who is saying this? Now, are these to send these? Are these the Moabites talking to Moabites, or is it the prophet? Is the prophet telling them to send sacrifices or send presents unto Zion? That Zion up here, of course, Zion is here in Jerusalem, is Jerusalem, to send these presents up here to see if if the Israelites will help you, that it will give you refuge. That seems to be the thought, though it's a difficult one to me. Now he says, brother, under the mount of the daughter of Zion. So you send lambs there, send a sacrifice, send a present there. For it shall be that as wandering birds, as a scattered nest, so shall the daughters of Moab be at the fords of the Arnon. Right? Now here's your Arnon here. So it's come here to try to get across. And escaping the coming of the Babylonians here, why, it's going to be like stir up a nest of birds, and they flutter and go every direction. Here are these daughters of Moab. They'll be like that. They'll be fluttering. What are we going to do? Where are we going? Trying to cross there in their haste and in their uncertainty. I think it's a pretty good picture of birds fluttering around. So these daughters of Moab will be fluttering. Now here he says here, give counsel, execute judgment. Make thy shade as the night in the midst of the noonday. Hide the outcast. Betray not the fugitive. Now who's saying that? Is that Moabites to Zion, asking Zion to give them counsel? Is it the prophet to Moab, telling them to go to Zion? Or is it the prophet to Moab and telling them how to entreat fugitive Jews that have come unto them? I don't know. They're difficult to say. But it sounds more like, in the light of this other, that he's telling them here to go to Zion and entreat Zion to give them refuge. That seems to be the thought to me. And at any rate, they don't do it. Now it goes on here, let mine outcast dwell with thee. Now that seems to be that maybe Zion asking, maybe Moab asking Zion, or maybe God telling the Moabites to let those that flee from Jerusalem find refuge there. The whole thing is a state of confusion. I mean, the land is in a state of confusion with the coming of the Assyrians, of the Babylonians. So whether it be in Moab or whether it be in Jerusalem. As for Moab, be thou a covert for him from the face of the destroyer. That seems like God is talking here. Let mine outcast dwell with thee. As for Moab, be thou a covert to him from the face of the destroyer. Maybe he's asking then Moab to give refuge to the Jews. So this passage here, I don't like to bring up passages I can't explain and don't know the answer to and leave her hanging, but this is one I'll have to leave hanging. But I don't know who's talking. I don't know who he has reference to. Whether it's Moab appealing to Zion, or some of them are Zion fleeing down into Moab and asking them to get fine help down there. Difficult to determine. For the extortioner is brought to naught. Destruction ceases. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. Now, they knew what he was talking about there. I don't. And a throne, now I know what this is. And a throne shall be established in loving kindness, and one shall sit thereon in truth in the tent of David, judging and seeking justice and swift to do righteousness. Now, let me give you what seems to me the best explanation right there in the passage. It seems to me that the idea is the prophet. He's telling the people of Moab to try to find refuge in Zion. All right? But they don't do it. We see in the next verse, they reject it. Their only hope is in God. Now, when the Babylonians come, unless they turn to God and flee to him and his headquarters in Zion, they'll find none. That will be it. Now, if they will do that, a remnant will be spared under the coming of the Son of David, that's the Messiah, who will rule and give them complete refuge. Now that seems to me to be the thought. The thought is, you seek refuge in God, in Zion. That's the only place of refuge. Now, if you do that, a remnant will be spared for the Messiah to come, and they'll find complete refuge in him, salvation there. Now, you may look over that and tell you what it's worth. I don't think we've reached a conclusion enough I don't think I'm clear enough on that to make a clear distinction. And in writing on that, that was the best I could do, is to try to point out the different possibilities and just leave it there. That's all I can do, anybody else can do on it. Now, the next one shows that they rejected that. And on this basis is one of the grounds on which I take the position that it was an appeal to them to go to Zion, find refuge there, and look then for the coming of the Messiah, just as the Jews would have to do. Now, but they reject it. Now notice, we have heard of the pride of Moab, that he is very proud, even of his arrogancy, and his pride, and his wrath. His boastings are naught. Therefore shall Moab wail for Moab, everyone shall wail, for the raisin cakes of Kir-Hareseth shall be mourned utterly stricken. Now, in their pride, they rejected that. They rejected that. Now, that's pointed out also over in Jeremiah 48. I want to look at Jeremiah for me just a moment here. That gives a little help on this. Jeremiah 48, I believe it's verse 7 that I want to start with here. All right? 48:7. For because thou hast trusted in thy works, in thy treasures, thou also shalt be taken. Now, this is a Moab up here in chapter 48, verse 1, talking about Moab. Now, here you've trusted in your works here. Now look at verse 11. Moab had been at ease from his youth, and he hath settled on his lees, and hath not been emptied from vessel to vessel, neither hath he gone into captivity. Therefore his taste remaineth in him, and his scent is not changed. Now to settle on your lees, that's an expression from wine making. You put the wine in this bottle, you leave it there, then you pour it off, and the settlings there were called the lees here. Now if you left it on that, it became kind of syrupy, and not just, but in pouring it from vessel to vessel, from time to time, it produced the sparkle and made the wine the very best. Now, Moab has settled on her lees. She's become, as it were, settled, syrupy, satisfied, of an inferior class here, and she's going to have to be poured off. Now, verse 14, how say ye, we are mighty men and valiant men, when they were not? Now, look at verse 29. We've heard of the pride of Moab, that he is very proud, his loftiness and his pride and his arrogancy. Now, this is 100 years after Isaiah, so the destruction hadn't come yet. Now, over here in verse 42, and Moab shall be destroyed from being a people, because he has magnified himself against Jehovah. Right? Now, that helps us a little bit to understand Isaiah, put the two together. So, in Moab's pride, she refused to turn to Jehovah or to listen here to the exhortation of the prophet to find refuge in him. And so now in her pride and arrogancy, she's destined to destruction. Pride goeth before fall, and before destruction, the Holy Spirit before fall. That's true of nations, true of individuals. All right? Now, the prophet goes on to say, I'm not going into all of these different towns here. That's no need. Now, verse 9, along with that verse 5 up in 15. Therefore I will weep with the weeping of Jazer, or the vine of Sibma. I will water thee with my tears. The prophet is deeply concerned about the condition of this kin, kin nation, a nation of kindred. Drop down to verse 11, which I read. My heart soundeth like a harp for Moab. Mine inward parts for Kerheres. All right, now, verse 13. This is the word that Jehovah spake concerning Moab in the past. Now, that past was probably an earlier prophecy by Isaiah. I don't know when, but to some time. But now Jehovah has spoken, saying, within 3 years, as the years of a hireling, the glory of Moab shall be brought into contempt with all the great multitude, and the remnant shall be very small and of no account. Now, what is that, the years of a hireling? 3 years. A hireling doesn't want to work a day over the number of days you paid him to work. The employer doesn't want him to work a day less. So it indicates an exact period. So within 3 years, then this is going to come upon them. Not a total destruction, for that hadn't come until 200 years later. But the terror of an invading force, and that would be the Babylonians, would come upon them, and they would be brought low, but not destroyed at that time. Well, all right, those two chapters then deal with Moab, the kindred people of the Jews, in which their vines are going to be destroyed, their pasture destroyed, they're going to lose all, many cities will be destroyed, but in this invasion they'll not be brought to a complete end. That's going to come later. But they're going to suffer mightily at the hands of the Babylonians, maybe the Syrians also. All right, any question over that? I don't think I've done a very good job of that, but it's just one of those things. All I want to do is get the idea of it, of the destruction of these cities, that God's in control, that God's foretelling what's going to take place, and it all comes to pass. Now, the next is Damascus. Damascus was the capital of Syria. It's reputed to be the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. I don't know that that's so. But now notice what I said, the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. That's the claim made by some scholars for it. I don't know if so or what it is, but I know it goes way back in antiquity. It was there when Abraham came into the land. And how far back of that it goes, I'm not sure. All right, but now here's Damascus. It was the capital of Syria for a long time. Now, it was located up here. Here is Jerusalem, and this goes on up like this. And over here, not like this, is Damascus. Here's Damascus then. Very ancient city and a very important city. Here was the mountains. The mountains that go up like this, here, over here, and this goes up through that valley. But Damascus was fed by two rivers, Arpa and Abana. You remember reading about them in the Bible. All right? Now, that made an oasis out of it. And it was a beautifully watered place with palm trees and all that. I was there one time. We were there the day that Nixon had been there. And that city was in a bedlam that day. But we did get into it and go down the street called Straight and all that and saw some of those places. But it was a very ancient city. I wish I could have seen more of it, but we couldn't. We saw all that we could. But I hear the prophecy against it. Now, about 300, the capital was moved over here to Antioch. To Antioch here on the Orontes River. Now, the Orontes River flowed north here and then went over into the sea. And then it was made the capital, and it was the capital in New Testament times. Antioch was. All right? The burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap. The cities of Aroa are forsaken. They shall be for flocks, which shall lie down, and none shall make them afraid. And the fortress, that fortress shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. They shall be as the glory of the children of Israel, saith Jehovah of hosts. Now, that suggests that they'll be destroyed, and the glory of the children of Israel would be what? It was taken away. Remember, the king of Israel and the king of Syria were the two in chapter 7 that came up against Ahaz. Now then, God was going to bring Israel to an end. Right now, the glory of Damascus will be as the glory of Israel, and the glory will be taken away. Her glory is going to be removed, and she shall be as the glory of the children of Israel. Right? And it shall come to pass in that day that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean. In other words, as I say, his glory will be taken away. And it shall be as when the harvestman gathereth the standing grain, and his arm reapeth the ears. Yea, it shall be as when one gleaneth ears in the valley of Rephaim. Yet there shall be left there in gleanings as the shaking of an olive tree, two or three berries in the top of the uttermost bough, four or five in the fruitful tree, said Jehovah, the God of Israel. Now, what does that mean? That means that here, that which had been fruitful, it was going to be reaped by these foreign kings, Assyria and Babylon, and then it'll be all that will be left will be a few gleaning grapes and a few gleaning olives here and there. In other words, the glory is taken away. It's going to be removed. In that day shall men look unto their Maker, and their eyes shall have respect to the Holy One of Israel. And they shall not look to the altars, the work of their hands, neither shall they have respect to that which their fingers have made, either the Asherim or the sun images. Now, that means this, that these nations are going to have to be brought to naught before they realize the emptiness of their idols and are willing to listen to Jehovah. That happened to all of them. Not all of them ever listened to God, but they're all going to be brought to an end before Jehovah establishes his spiritual kingdom. Now, I think that's the main thought in the dealing with these heathen nations. They're all going to be brought to an end and realize the emptiness and the vanity of those idols in which they had trusted. They'll then be willing to listen to something else. And I think that is going to happen to our own people. I think that we're going to have to be brought low. This idea now, market here being over 2,000, whatever they talk about on the stock market there, or over 2,000. I remember when it hit 800, I thought that was a lot, and just a little while later, 1,000. Now, what does that look like? I don't know. I'm not a financier. It looks, or an economist, it looks to me like we are headed for another terrible fall, a depression, such as hit us before, and it'll be worse this time. Why do I say that? Manufacturers are closing up. Closing down. People are being thrown out of work, more and more out of work. And the dollar is going down. So many things are taking place. It looks to me like, I'm not a prophet, but it looks to me like we are building up for another collapse. Mines are closing down, and all this. And if it does, it'll be worse than the other, because the people then were willing to have enough honor that they're willing to work at any price. Today they're not. Today it's going to be a robbery, killing and stealing and all of that, such as we've never seen before. You might remember that. Then remember, I'm not prophesying. I'm not a prophet. I'm simply basing that conclusion on what has always happened in nations. When they get to the point that they're putting their trust in their idols, putting their trust in their military, putting their trust in their intellectual ability to get out of these situations, they've always fallen. When they hit the bottom, and then they'd be willing to listen and see if there's something better than what they had. I'm fearful of that. But at any rate, Damascus will hit the bottom, and when she does, in that day shall men look unto their Maker, he says here, and turn away from their Asherim or the sun images. Now verse 9, in that day shall their strong cities be as the forsaken places in the wood and on the mountaintop, which were forsaken from before the children of Israel, and it shall be a desolation. And even before the children of Israel came in. Now, so here, you're going to see a desolation in your nation. And hard times coming to Damascus and Syria. For thou hast forgotten the God of thy salvation, and hast not been mindful of the rock of thy strength. Therefore thou plantest pleasant plants, and settest it with strange slips. In the day of thy planting, thou hedgest it in, and in the morning thou makest thy seed to blossom. But the harvest fleeth away in the day of grief and of desperate sorrow. Can we make an application of that principle in our own country? I think we can. That here, the strong places are forsaken, and all of that, and things become desperate. Why? Because thou hast forsaken the God of thy salvation. Wherein alone is salvation? Wherein alone is true wisdom found? Only in God and in His way. What do we turn to today? Humanism, worldliness, the basest form of conduct and behavior. I don't think you can read of anything any worse among the old pagans than you hear broadcast on the television each day. I don't know anything about our high schools and schools, but it almost sounds like that what they're doing there is teaching them how to have sex and buy these contraceptives and all of that, and no moral word is ever uttered against it. is always simply trying not to get caught. If you do get caught, why then, God will take care of you in that. You can't go on like that. And in our politics, corruption, world without end, in everything, in the court system, seldom you get justice. Occasionally you do. Can that go on? No. No, and when it explodes and it's over, maybe it is the end of the whole world in time. Maybe people are willing to think and turn to God. Now, what we must do is keep alive an understanding of God and the faith in the church, that when that comes, there'll be a remnant to preach and take the word to them. I think that's our real job right now. I don't see much opportunity to winning people right now. But if we get have the church ready, when that time comes, I think they'll be ready to listen. Maybe I'm wrong. But that's just a guess. I'm just on the basis of what he said before. Now notice, brother, the uproar of many peoples that roar like the roaring of the seas, and the rushing of nations that rush like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations shall rush like the rushing of mighty waters, but he shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountain before the wind, and like the whirling dust before the storm. Who's in control? God is. That's, I think, the thing we need to learn here. Here are these nations fighting with Afghanistan, Russia, and other wars all over the world here, and all of that. But God, when he gets through them, they chase it, runs it off. At eventide, behold, terror, and before the morning, they are not. This is a portion of them that despoil us, and a lot of them that rob us. The us will be the faithful remnant, faithful few. And so those who oppose God's principles, and the few righteous that ever remain, that there never is more than a remnant, ultimately they're going to fail. I think this is the Christian's encouragement today, just as it was the remnant's encouragement in the long ago. Truth is always going to triumph. Righteousness is going to be victorious. You may look for a while as if we're going down, but we aren't. We aren't. Well, any question over there? So, without trying to get the details of all this, let's get the lesson, God's teaching. I'm going to handle the situation. So, that's one reason I don't particularly worry about what comes. I'm not worried about atomic bombs. I'm not worried about an economic collapse. Sure, I'd hate to lose overnight that for which we've worked all of our lives. I'd hate to do it, so would you. But if I do, so what? I'm looking for a city which has the foundations. The builder maker is God. I'm looking for something better than we have here. Though this is mighty fine, mighty beautiful. I read a story today of an old priest. Of course, it's a fictitious story, I know. But this old priest here had lived in this monastery here, and an angel came and told him, said, "You've got to take you home." Well, he said, "I haven't seen..." He said, "Why do I go to?" He said, "It's a beautiful world I'm going to." "No, not if you haven't found any beauty here." "So I haven't had time." "Well," said, "you got 2 years. I'm going to give you 2 more years. So he left. He was found out on the mountain by this fellow, and he left and went out then into the mountains and was spending his 2 years enjoying the beautiful world that God had given, which he didn't know existed. And I think that's true of us. I think there's a beauty all about us that we become unconscious of in our struggle for this, that, and something else, and worried about the few little old things that could bother us and all that. We fail to see the beauty of this world. It's a beautiful world, but man's destroying it, and one of these days God's going to remove it. But let's learn to enjoy what we do have, and whatever may come. Be able, like last Sunday night when we read that, Sunday before, whichever it was, read that last few verses of Habakkuk, where he says, "Oh, the fig tree shall not flourish, nor fruit be found in the vine. The olive shall not bear its fruit. There'll be no grain in the field. There'll be no herd in the stall. There'll be no flock in the pasture. Yet will I trust in Jehovah. I will joy in the God of my salvation." Take away from the faithful everything that he has. If you've got a true faith, you still want to hold on to God. And that's what we've got to learn to do. So then, if a collapse comes, if we're still living to see it when it comes, why then, we will have a faith to which people can look. I had one of my co-teachers in Abilene when I was there. She went to France to study French. She was riding in the train there reading her Bible. She's a fine lady. And a French lady across there asked her what she was reading. She told her. She asked her, "Tell us something about it." And this Christian lady told her something of her faith. French lady looked at her and said, "Oh, that I had a faith like that." We don't have a faith like that. Now, you see, it was healed a woman that hadn't made an impression. So can we. So can we. So whatever may come, let's be ready for it. I think that I don't have time to go into this next one. I wrote that. Let me see. How many minutes do I have? I've got enough time. Yes, I have. Let me read this next chapter. All right. Now, here is one against Ethiopia. Now, Ethiopia, remember, is down here, way down here in Egypt. You come down into Egypt. Here's, well, it's really, really the southern part of Egypt there. So here's Ethiopia. The land of the rushing of winds. Rustling of winds, rather, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, ascended ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of papyrus upon the waters. That is, those vessels that would go up on the Nile, but were not, but couldn't get farther. Upon the waters, go ye swift messengers to a nation tall and smooth, to a people terrible from their beginning. Onward, a nation that meeteth out and treadeth down, whose land the rivers divide. All right, now the prophet is speaking here in this, telling them what to do. Now, they are there in confusion. They are seeking something. He said, all you inhabitants of the world and ye dwellers on the earth, when an ensign is lifted up on the mountain, see ye, and when the trumpet is blown, hear ye. Now, we've had that ensign before. When God raised an ensign, rally around it. Now, here these Ethiopians are rushing here and yonder, trying to make up with the envoys, making alliances. But when ensign is lifted up, see it. For thus hath Jehovah said unto me, I will be still and I will behold in my dwelling place, like clear heat in summer, in sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the blossom is over, and the flower becometh a ripening grape, he will cut off the sprigs with pruning hooks, and the spreading branches will he take away and cut down. They shall be left together under the ravenous birds of the mountains, and to the beasts of the earth, and the ravenous birds shall summer upon them, and all the beasts of the earth shall winter upon them. Here's the fall of Ethiopia. She's going down, and will be for the birds of prey upon her. In that time shall a present be brought from Jehovah, shall be brought unto Jehovah of hosts, from a people tall and smooth, even from a people terrible, from their beginning onward, a nation that meeteth out and treadeth down, whose land the rivers divide, to the place of the name of Jehovah of hosts, Mount Zion. Now it seems to me that that's saying what I've been saying. That here, when they have hit the bottom, and all's come upon them, and they've been reaped to nothing much left, then they'll bring an offering to Jehovah. So that seems to be the thought throughout these prophecies, class. The major thought. That here is a judgment from God. A judgment intended to bring the people to the realization that without God, there's nothing. That with Him, in Him is every hope. This is the lesson I get from the study of the judgment of these nations. They are all going to be brought low. But God will establish His kingdom that will stand forever. Well, that's another one of them. Now, the next one is a long one. The burden of Egypt. We'll take that up when we come back. And we'll start there with chapter 19. I think you have here about, I forget how many chapters now, several here that deal with Egypt. And we'll come back to Babylon again over here. And burden of Tyre, long one on Tyre. But none of these are quite as lengthy as Ezekiel's. Ezekiel is the one that has the longest prophecy concerning Tyre and Egypt of any of them. They're really long. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. So what I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to show, is all pagan heathen nations are going to be brought to naught. Only in Jehovah can people find refuge. And when they're brought to naught and hit the bottom, then there's a possibility that they'll turn to God, find refuge there. So that encourages us to continue faithful and to be strong, be ready and prepared, that when a time comes that people may look to us, we'll have something to offer them. Right now, not a great many Christians could have much to offer them. They themselves are not as zealous and earnest as they might be. But when that comes, maybe they'll be more earnest at that time. All right, we'll leave it there, and we'll start next time with verse 19, the burden of Egypt here, and take about two chapters for that. That'll be a four weeks from tonight. I guess it'll be 4 weeks. I'll be gone 3 weeks, yeah. 4 weeks from tonight, I will be back for another study. Class is excused.